Thursday is this one where we have the scaling of entanglement entropy as a size, as a function of the size of a block in one dimension and in two dimensions. And then we didn't look at three dimensions, but you can believe that. So what we saw is that if the system is in one dimension, if the system is gapped, we have that the entropy as a so we have a block of size L, and as you increase the size of the block, the entropy saturates to a constant. If the system was, so that would be for the gap case. If the system is gapless, then we'll see in one dimension that the entropy keeps growing as a logarithm of L. As you increase L, the size of your block, the entropy keeps growing in a very particular way, log L. Now, in two dimensions, what we saw is that we also, for gap systems, we find some behavior. So the entropy grows. So in a block of size L times L, the entropy grows proportional to the size of the boundary. Now, in the gapless case, we found two situations. The first one was when the boundary law was still fulfilled, OK? A strict boundary law was obeyed. But we also saw another case where the boundary law was corrected by logarithmic corrections. Okay? There were a logarithmic violation of the boundary law. And this is a generic trend. In three dimensions, we would see again that we have the gap case and some gapless case would obey a boundary law again, but that there were cases where we would see logarithmic corrections. And what are these cases? Well, this happens when you have, when you solve, these are free fermions, so you can solve them, and you can look at the dispersion relation, and you count the number of zero modes. These zero modes are organized, can be organized in a Fermi surface, so that would mean that we have a continuum of zero modes. And it turns out that if the Fermi surface forms a D minus one dimensional manifold, then you'll see these logarithmic corrections. Okay, so what does this mean in one dimension? It means if you have a finite number of zero modes in one dimension, then you'll see logarithmic corrections. In two dimensions, it means if you have a one-dimensional Fermi surface, you'll see logarithmic corrections. In two dimensions, it means that if you have, sorry, in three dimensions, it means that if you have a two-dimensional Fermi surface, you'll see these corrections. All right. And so the final summary then is this one, that we have a boundary law. Or a boundary law with logarithmic corrections. Okay, so what else can we say about free fermions before we go more general? Well, we can follow investigating something that we started to see yesterday, which was that in one dimension, when we had a one-dimensional system, remember this logarithm. So let me write this. So that's going to be, we had 4.3 was d equal to 1, 4.4 was d equal to 2. And so now we do 4.5. We'll look at the structure. Of the Fermi surface. And in particular, we want to try to understand these corrections a little bit more. So what we saw is that for d equal to 1, in one dimension, we were seeing always not just that the entropy would scale with log L, but actually there was some coefficient here. And mysteriously, and you did this as part as a tutorial on Wednesday, this k, you saw that it was taking some value, 1 over 3, right? And the question is, what does this mean? Why is it 1 over 3? And actually, this was when we have two zero modes. Right? So if I plot here the dispersion relation, you had something like this. We had zero mode and zero mode, right? That's a dispersion relation. And there were 2 points where this, where the energy of a quasi-particle would be equal to zero. So 2 zero modes, okay? And we found this. Now, I also show you a plot where we had another theory which had 1 zero mode. And actually, in that case, this coefficient in front of the logarithm was 1/6. So for 1 zero mode. So, you know, it would be natural to think that what we have is that, in general, k is equal to maybe 1/6 times the number of zero modes. Okay. So maybe what's happening then when we have a Fermi surface is that we again have infinitely many such contributions. So let's try to see this. Let's try to see that this is indeed the case. And one way to investigate that possibility is the following. Let's make an experiment. So let's go to d equal to 2, two dimensions. So this would be for gamma equal to 0, the simplest Hamiltonian we consider, which means that the Hamiltonian is just hopping terms between nearest neighbors on a square lattice. Okay, that's the Hamiltonian, simplest one that we consider. So that would be on the square lattice. And then I showed you yesterday, and sooner than you expect, you'll deal with that yourself. Again, there is some dispersion relation. So if you plot the dispersion relation, there was that nice figure in three dimensions. And now if we look at the Fermi surface, so the places, so that would be Fermi surface. If we look, so this is kx, this is ky, and we have all these zero modes, okay? If you choose kx and ky to be on this line, you'll get that the dispersion relation is equal to zero. So Fermi surface means that the dispersion relation for this choice of kx, ky is equal to zero, okay? That is, these guys here are the two-dimensional version of these 2 points here, okay? We're looking at how many zero modes we have. So this is something that I think you'll be dealing with. Is that a secret, Dennis? Is that a secret? So yeah, homework. Do they have the homework already? Or?
Yeah.
But have they seen it?
No, they will see this after this.
OK, so bad news, right? The homework. You'll have to see this. Now, so yeah. So now let's do something related to the homework. But it's an experiment to test the idea that maybe the coefficient that we detect, this k here in the one-dimensional case, maybe it's proportional to the number of zero modes. Okay, and that's exciting again because we're talking about the property that we obtain. We can look at the scaling of entanglement entropy on the ground state, okay, just the ground state, and we can learn how many zero modes we have, which is a property of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this means that just by studying the entanglement of ground state, we can learn about properties that are not, that you would not expect to be just from a ground state. It's a property of the whole phase.
But here, the zeros, they form this close square, so.
A continuum.
Yeah, they form continuum. So the coefficient will be 1/6 times.
Infinite.
Right?
Infinite, yeah. But let's not go radical. So what we can do instead is we can make an experiment. And what we can do is we can build a quasi one-dimensional version of this two-dimensional system. So what we're going to do is we're going to consider, see, this was for a square lattice in the thermodynamic limit. Now let's consider the following experiment. We'll consider a cylinder. So here we are going to identify this with this, okay? This cylinder will have length Lx, sorry, n, nx, which is going to be infinite. So in one direction, we still have the plane, if you want. But in the other direction, we won't take the thermodynamic limit. So in this direction, we'll make it finite. And why? OK? And then, so what is this? This is an infinite cylinder, OK? Square lattice is here. That's what we have, right? And what happens then, what we see is you can write a dispersion relation, again, for this problem. And what you see is that this dispersion relation, so our goal is to see how we modify this picture, right? This was for the, this was in the case of ny also infinite. Now let's see how this is modified. So what's a dispersion relation? This is proportional to cosine 2 pi over nx kx plus cosine 2 pi over ny ky. Now, what this means is, in the x direction, this quantity here, and x is infinite, so this is as small as you want. So what we have is a continuum. This thing here is a continuum of values. But on this side here, we have discrete, meaning that because ny is finite, ky takes values from ny minus 2 divided by 2, so minus this, ny minus 1 divided by 2 plus 1, all the way to ny minus 1 divided by 2. And how many values are this? Well, there are ny values here. Okay? So what we have is, in one direction, in the x direction, we have a continuum of possibilities. But in the y direction, we only have a finite number of possibilities. So what this means, for instance, let's take n y equal to 4. And let me show this is kx, this is ky. So what we have is then that in this particular case, we'll have possible values of kx and ky such that we have some, that's not the best. So let me try orange. So what this means is all the possible vectors that may appear in this expression. So the y, ky, can only take certain values, whereas kx can take any value. Okay? And now this is where we have defined this function. And what we're going to say, what we see is that now we would like to find when this is equal to 0. Now we would like to find, see, maybe in green, this equal to 0. Okay. So what we see is that for any value of ky that we have, right, we have in this case four different values of ky. If you give me this value, then I can look for ways of matching that value. So I want this to be equal to 0, right? For any value that I put here, I can play around with kx so that I match that value. But this is a cosine, so just think about the structure of a cosine. Between say minus pi and pi. And what you realize is that if I give you a value, say this value here, I can always match it, okay, with a cosine twice. So basically what's happening is that we had this structure here. And now when we look, so this would be the case in the thermodynamic limit, the number of zero modes. But now in the discrete case, what we find is for every value, eligible value of ky, we can find a kx such that we'll have a zero mode. And so this happens in this case for four different values, so we obtain 8 zero modes. Okay, so this is the picture. So in green, what you have is the new structure of zero modes that is induced by a finite, by considering a cylinder where the width is finite. Okay, so if we increase the width, say ny, then we'll put more and more zero modes in this structure. And in the limit of ny being infinite, we'll recover the Fermi surface. But for ny finite, we have only a finite number of zero modes. And so what do we expect in this case? So what we're going to do now is we're going to take our cylinder of width ny in this direction. And we can compute the ground state. These are free fermions. And then we can look at the region A that has length L, okay, as usual. So we will trace out the rest, and we'll just look at the entropy of this region L, A. So this is going to be some entropy as a function of L, okay? And what we expect is some constant times log L. That's what we expect. But now what we want to see is how this constant here depends on the number of zero modes. And we already know the number of zero modes, so the number of zero modes is equal to 2 times ny, okay? So a natural expectation, if our hypothesis is correct, is that k will be proportional to ny, okay? So that is a way of counting how many zero modes you have in your system. You just compute the scaling of time and entropy, look at this constant, right? And then you can read how many zero modes you have. Okay, so this is what we could do. And what this usually means in practice is that some student would do it. And now I think it's this one. And so yesterday after the lecture, I thought, well, that would be a way of illustrating what's going on here. So I asked Yang Gang if he could have a look at this problem. And he sent me this plot. So let me show you the scaling of entanglement entropy as a function of the L, the size of this block, okay, for the cylinder. And I think it takes like 5 seconds from there. OK, and here we have it. So what do we see here? So each line corresponds to fixing the width of a cylinder. Okay, so for instance, take the first line. This is a cylinder of width 2. So that's a very small, very thin cylinder. And then when you look at the entanglement entropy, how it scales, this is logarithmic scale already, and you see a perfect match. So it's some k times log L, as we expected. Okay? So it's logarithmic scaling. Now, as you change the number of the width of the cylinder from say 2 to 4, right? So now it's the cylinder is still infinite, but it's a bit wider. Then you see again perfect logarithmic scaling, but with a constant that actually is twice as much. Okay? And you can do this for very different widths, and that's what we have here, from width 2 all the way to width 20. And then from each of these widths, you can compute the constant k. And now if you want to see how it depends, how this constant k depends on the width, well, you just, this plot is showing for the width of, for each width of the cylinder, how much the constant in front of the logarithm was, okay? And you get this. So you put a fit there, and you see that it's, well, it's exactly, up to numerical precision, is the number, is the width, times 1/3 in front. Okay? So we have, this really means 1/3 of ny, which is 1/3 of twice ny in terms of, 1/6 of the number of zero modes, right? For width ny, we have 2 times ny zero modes. So what this is saying is that, indeed, what we're seeing here is that this hypothesis was exactly correct, that you can understand that each zero mode is contributing the same to this entropy. Is that clear? So now we understand that when we could consider a very, very large cylinder, that the larger the cylinder is, in this direction, we'll get that there are the center, well, not center, this coefficient keeps growing, and it will become infinite in the thermodynamic limit. But what's interesting here is to understand that the Fermi surface really is made of zero modes, and that each zero mode is bringing its contribution to the entanglement entropy. All right, so we'll leave this here for a sec. I think this is the magic bottom. All right. So, and so we're almost done with, or we're done with three fermions. And what we want to do now is to move on. But was it, so before we move on, I want to explain, well, this was for three fermions. So what? Is nature made of three fermions? Well, I don't know. But there are other possibilities. And so it would be interesting to understand that classification up there if it teaches us something beyond three fermions. And so the answer is actually yes. And what else do we learn? So how is this? 1, 2, 3. So it turns out that, for instance, systems where, so we've seen that there are systems that don't obey a strict boundary law, but actually have this logarithmic violation. We've learned this from free fermions. But it turns out that free fermions are not just some useless idealization. So free fermions would describe a Fermi gas where the particles, the fermions, don't see each other. But it turns out that we could also consider Fermi liquid. And it turns out that the Fermi liquid, that would be an interacting gas of fermions. So we could add interactions to our fermions. And at low energies, it behaves very similarly to a Fermi gas. So there are some, the quasi-particles acquire some finite lifetime. And there are some modifications, but the basic structure of a Fermi surface survives. So if we study a Fermi liquid, which is no longer free fermions, okay, then we'll see, again, the same structure. We'll see if there is a Fermi surface there, then we'll see logarithmic violations of the boundary law. But more interest or more exotic would be the case of a spin Bose metal. What is this? This is a system. Now fermions are gone from the picture. So we have a system of spins. And this typically is, or models for this typically involve a triangular lattice or variations of that. And what we have here is just spin degrees of freedom. So purely bosonic. Okay? There are no fermions involved. And what we have in this system is the spins are sitting on the sides of this lattice, and then there is some Heisenberg interaction between them. But then there is also some spin ring interaction that involves all the spins in this plaquette. Okay, so it's an exotic. I mean, you have to put in some fancy interactions there. Okay? But it turns out that this system, and this is of interest. I mean, this is being studied in the last few years and still now. This system develops some low energy physics that are parallel to having a Fermi surface. Okay, so there are no fermions in the microscopic description. But at low energies, it behaves as if it has, well, it's called a Bose surface, not Fermi surface. But the essence is the same there. And as a result, we also see logarithmic corrections of entanglement entropy in this system. Okay. And the fun part is that we cannot solve this type of Hamiltonians. But we can put them maybe on a cylinder. Okay, So why do they say that they, where is the evidence that there is something like a Fermi surface here? Well, what they did actually is they put this Hamiltonian on a thin cylinder, and they use a particular technique for one-dimensional systems called DMRG, and we'll talk about this a bit next week. And what they did was precisely this experiment we just described, which is gone somewhere, where they put the system on a cylinder with finite width, and they look at the scaling of entanglement entropy. Okay, so by looking just at the how entanglement entropy would scale, they realized that again, they had that the entanglement entropy was scaling as log L plus a coefficient that depended again on the width, was growing with the width of the cylinder. So, you know, I just told you a story about free fermions, and to some extent, who cares? It's free fermions. We understand everything about free fermions. But it turns out that by that this method that I described for free fermions, this observation that the scaling of entanglement entropy has a coefficient here that depends on the number of zero modes. Now you can apply it to a system that you cannot even solve in two dimensions. You can put it on a cylinder, okay, and observe the same thing. If you observe the same thing, then you think, okay, what I have there is indication that in the terminal, in two dimensions, I'll have a Fermi surface, okay, or the equivalent of a Fermi surface. So a continuum of zero modes, basically. All right, so then this brings us to the last subject I want to discuss. Yeah?
Just make two observations, but maybe something you'd like to mention. The first is that, so we consider the dimension of some system like free fermion or some liquid. If there are Fermi surface, say d-dimensional case, if there is a d minus one dimensional
yes.
surface, then the entanglement entropy of the size system size L will be L d minus 1 log L.
Yes.
And with zero modes but no Fermi surface L d minus 1. But I think there is someone asked questions, say if there are still some Fermi surface but the dimension is lower, say
yes.
d minus 2.
Yes.
Based on your account of zero modes, then the subleading correction term should be the first leading term is L d minus 1. The subleading term based on your
should be
LD minus 2 log L.
LD, right.
Correct? Is that correct?
So no, I don't want to, I don't know the answer to your question, but I'll say that anything that is not leading might be hidden. So it, you know, one can try to study this problem with free fermions. I haven't looked into this. I don't know if anybody has looked into this.
But it's just something right?
So right, it might be. But then in practice, you have to take into consideration, for instance, the geometry of your block. So it turns out that in practice, if you have a block, say a square block, then the edges may give you also logarithmic contributions. So it's much more complex than this. So here, I wanted to focus only on the leading contribution. But yes, there are many things to be explored in this research area. And this maybe I should emphasize more, which is that this is work in progress. This is all work in progress. Okay? And I'll show you that in a second, because I was looking for examples of what I wanted to explain later. And I saw the papers are from March this year, so last month. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was wondering about your cylinder example. Use the logarithmic correction, which means you're trying to say that there's a one-dimensional Fermi surface, but really you have just 8 points, right?
Right. What we saw is, okay, if we were in two dimensions, meaning n, y, and n, x infinite, then we would have a continuum of zero modes, okay? We would have a Fermi surface of dimension 1. But what we're trying to see now is what this fact has, so what the consequences of this are when you consider a cylinder, where one direction is infinite and the other one is finite. And what we saw is that instead of having the Fermi surface, what we obtain is some discrete version of it. But how discrete this is, or the number of zero modes that we have, grows as we try to take n, y back to the thermodynamic limit.
Right. So your table is only for the total dynamic limit?
Yes. No, that's... So that's the final result. That's what you want to remember. And here what I'm saying is that you can play around. So what does it mean to be in one dimension or two? Maybe you can have quasi one dimensional systems. And there should be a smooth transition between one case and the other. And we were exploiting this to conclude that actually we can even count how many zero modes we have and how the number of zero modes grows with ny. Okay? And that this is actually a technique that is being used to study a system that we cannot solve in two dimensions. So we don't know much about this system in two dimensions. We know that it's behaving as if it had an effective Fermi surface. Yeah?
Here, you said that the coefficient of k is what goes like ny. The ny in 2D would take a square L by L.
No, no. Remember the geometry that I'm using. I'm using a cylinder and my region, the region here. The region here is taking the whole of ny, right? So,
yeah, yeah.
So it's not a square.
So in the thermodynamic limit, that your entanglement entropy would be like the size of the system times log L.
It would be ny times log L.
Yeah, but ny is...
It's going to be infinite.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that doesn't reproduce the thing that you had before.
I never discussed the geometry before. I never said we'll have a situation where one direction is going to be infinite.
Okay. But isn't that what you're trying to get to? That you're trying to use the cylinder?
No, no, look. So one thing is the size of your system, nx times ny. Okay? The other one is the size of your block. So the results on that table assume that you are, the top table, assume that you are in the thermodynamic limit as far as the system is concerned. And then we look at the scaling of the size of the block.
Yeah, yeah.
And here you have a situation where the size of the block, at least this direction, is equal to the size of the system in the y direction. So if you want to interpret this, I mean, you don't want to try to interpret it on that table.
Okay.
Because that table, we assume that there is ny, which is infinite, and then ly, which is finite. Okay?
So you're using now
This is a one-dimensional system, and you want to interpret the result that we get there in terms of the first row on that table. Okay. And if you want, we can talk more about this. But yeah.
I do have last thing.
Okay.
So the zero modes counting only works if the property of these zero modes are the same.
That's correct. That's correct.
Because this coefficient relates to the same.
Yeah. And this is one thing you're. Hold on. I'll talk about central charge in a minute. So this is telling you that each zero mode is contributing the same. Yes. So all the zero modes here are behaving in a similar way. Okay? And if you want to talk about central charge, just wait a second. All right. So five. Entanglement. So now let's really forget about fermions. And let's look at the big picture. Let's look at a more generic case. So the first thing is we want to see what we're learning here. Okay, what are we learning about physical systems? The first observation is that the boundary law or even these logarithmic violations of it or corrections of it, this is telling us, this seems to be related to the locality of the underlying Hamiltonian. So this is a property of ground states of local Hamiltonians. Okay? So it seems to be a universal feature. This seems to be something that happens all the time. Okay? So we're learning about a universal feature of ground states in these special dimensions. Now, that's that's big, right? So suddenly we understood something about all ground states. Okay? Maybe it doesn't teach us much about specific ground states, but we have understood a property that all ground states have. And that was the key insight to the development of new ways of describing many body states, okay? Understanding that there was this structure. And the whole of the next week, we'll see that just this insight will allow us to indeed find efficient ways of describing many body wave functions. Now, that's one first observation. Oh, I don't know what happened. But then there is another way in which we can learn about universality through entanglement. Just 1 second. So I was, some of you have been taking the course with Pedro. And he was telling you all the time about universality classes and the RG flow. And I think you've seen this also with John Berlinski before. And so there is this other notion of universality. So when I say universal here, I mean everybody. Okay? And now when I say universality here, I mean that many different theories behave in the same way, say at the critical point. Okay? But then you have different universality classes. So you have a group of theories that a criticality behave in this way, another group of theories that a criticality behave in another way. So it turns out that entanglement is also the key to be able to distinguish between these universality classes. Okay?
So you have this double arrow. So I see how you are showing us the locality of the Hamiltonian gives us the boundary law. But does it go the other way? Also,
okay, so this arrow means read in this direction. It means that there is some level of association. We don't understand this.
Right.
Okay, so we didn't prove that if you had a local Hamiltonian, you have a boundary law. I'm only claiming that that's what we see that happens. So it would be very nice to be able to turn this into maybe an implication in one direction, in the other, or even both ways. Okay, but at the moment, it's just saying we are seeing that there is something common to all ground states that we know of local Hamiltonians.
Okay, yeah, because you told us that the boundary law is a description of the ground states, whereas the Hamiltonian is described much more, right?
That's true, but not so. This is a property of the ground state,
mm-hmm.
but the ground state of local Hamiltonians.
Okay,
and this is just a claim. That's what we see. We don't have a proof, but that always happens. Okay, so let's go then. Let's talk about universality. In the sense that, in the standard sense, universality classes. So what we want to see now is that we can use the scaling of entanglement to characterize fixed points of the renormalization group flow. And you know that these fixed points can describe either gap phases or gapless phases. Okay. So I was looking at Pedro's lecture from Monday, and he was saying, oh, this field theory is when it's a gap case, it's a boring theory. Okay? Whenever you have, so you always end up with boring theory. Well, it's not true in the sense that you can have gap theories that in the infrared limit, the fixed point, they are flowing to a fixed point of the RG flow, which still has some form of fun part, which is topological order. Okay, so we can correct. We'll see that we can, or I'm just going to show you that we can use entanglement to actually learn about these fixed points of the RG flow, both for critical or gapless fixed points and for gap fixed points. Okay. And so let me start with the gapless case. So what I want to consider is a quantum criticality. And in this case, I want to consider this corresponds, or I'm going to look at CFTs in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And so what is a quantum, or what is a CFT in 1 plus 1 dimensions? Well, I don't have time to explain everything, but I can tell you that This is a special type of quantum field theory that describes precisely a fixed point of the RG flow, and that it's characterized by conformal data. And conformal data it contains elements such as the central charge, but also a list of primary fields. And then we have also conformal dimensions for these primary fields. So there is a minimal set of information that you want to specify, such as the central charge, a complete list of primary fields, their conformal dimensions, and the operator product expansion. And the importance, the relevance of being able to identify this information is that the rest of the theory is completely determined by the symmetries, okay, of a fixed point of the RG flow. So if you give me this information about the theory, then I know exactly in which universality class you are. Okay? So this is a complete description of a universality class. And for instance, if this was, as an example, if this was the Ising model, critical Ising model, then we would have that the central charge is equal to 1/2. We'll have the primary fields are the identity, the spin, so there are three primary fields. And I think this will connect well with the class on CFT, but if you are not taking that class, don't worry. Just, you know, I'm just illustrating this with an example where we would have that the conformal dimensions, so h bar here will be 0, 0. In this case, we would have 1 over 16, 1 over 16. In this case, we would have 1/2 and 1/2. So this would be, and then the operator product expansion coefficients. In this particular case, will be some choice of coefficients. Okay. So the idea is, if you give me all this information, I have a complete description of the universality class. You want me to go? All right. So the exciting thing is that with just looking at the scaling of entanglement entropy, right? Now, finally, let's explain what Eubin was hinting at already. Is that in one dimension, if you look at the ground state and you look at how entanglement entropy scales, it turns out that this coefficient that we were discussing all the time, but this, so C in here, this coefficient is the central charge divided by 3. So what this means is that they give you a critical theory. You don't know what's happening. You don't know what theory you have. But if you manage to compute, to observe how the entanglement entropy scales with the size of the block, automatically you learn what the central charge of the theory is. Okay? And why is this relevant? So just to give you an example, there are these called minimal models. I'm going to use this part here. So for if the central charge, it happens that if the central charge is smaller than 1, then we have unitary minimal models. And this is a collection of CFTs. It turns out that if you impose unitarity there, that all the CFTs with central charge smaller than 1 are completely characterized by the central charge. So the central charge in this case gives you 1 minus this expression. And so to give you some examples, C equal to 1/2 would correspond to the critical Ising model. C, so I'm taking now m equal, so m here is equal to 3, 4 integers from. And so C, so I'm taking just m equal to 3, m equal to 4 now, and so on. Just to give you some names that may be familiar. So this would be the Ising model, critical Ising model. Then we have the tricritical. Then we have the three-state POTS model. And then we would have the tricritical. Three-state POTS model. Okay, so and this goes on. We are talking about this series now. Okay, so, but this is really it's big, right? Because it says, okay, I just told you we're complete. The universality class is characterized by all this information. But it turns out that if we happen to find that this constant here, so we give us a critical Hamiltonian. We don't know what the universality class is, but if we compute entanglement entropy, okay, and we see that C is smaller than 1, then we go to the table and we have completely characterized. There is only one entry on our table for C is smaller than 1. So we can go and look at, and we have already understood or completely characterized the universality class, okay, of this phase transition. So just by looking at entanglement entropy. So before we were obsessed with entanglement, you would have to maybe identify what the order parameters are, how they decay with the distance, then try to feed some, you know, polynomial decay. I don't know, very complicated, and especially it was case by case, right? So it depended on the Hamiltonian they gave you. Here we have an absolutely standard way of doing things, which, of course, it involved finding the ground state, but you would also have to do it with previous methods. So once you have the ground state, if you can tell me how entanglement scales, I don't know who the primary fields are. I don't know what the order parameter is. I don't care. I just look at this quantity. I go to the table, and I learn everything I want after that. Okay. So this is big. Now, I think we're running short of time here, as usual. Let me at least announce. Oh, I see. All right. 5.3, another case, topological order, which corresponds to a topological quantum field theory. And I'm considering the case 2+1 dimensions. And so topological order, actually, the third week of this course, Xiaogang Wen will tell you everything you want to know about topological order. Okay? Well, I don't know, depending on how much you want to know. But so I don't have time to explain things in detail. But the message that Xiaogang will take later on and will expand on is that here, again, we have these theories. We said the conformal field theories are described by all these conformal data. Now, these theories, which are gap fixed points of the RG flow, okay? So now we have a gap fixed point of the RG flow. This is what Pedro was hiding from you, that gap fixed points are also very interesting. And they correspond to non-trivial field theories as well. Then in this case, what you have is an anion model. So instead of giving you the conformal data to characterize a conformal field theory, in this case, what you have to know is what the anion model is. And how do you characterize this? Well, there will be a number of anion types. And then we'll have, so for instance, for the toric coat, which I think, well, I know Xiaogang will tell you about in 2 weeks from now, then the anion types would be, there are 4 anion types, which I'm just going to list and not say much about it. But basically, these are different types of quasi-particles that you have in the system. Okay, so if you want to characterize this fixed point, you have to tell me what the quasi-particle types are. But you have to tell me also a number of things. Say, another property is quantum dimensions. And these quantum dimensions, and this, so for each, so if you have anion type, collection of anion types I, for each anion type, you have to give me the quantum dimension, some quantity. And then the quantum dimension of the identity for the toric code. So that's an example. For the toric code, we have the identity has the same quantum dimension as the other types of anions, and it's all equal to 1, okay, in this example. And then we have, and from the, here, an important quantity is the total quantum dimension. Total quantum dimension. And this is given by this expression. And now I know you are not seeing this. So, well, I'll lift it in a second. Can you see this? So I'm just saying there is a quantity here, which is the sum of the squares, the square root of the sum of squares of these quantum dimensions, and so on. There are some number of properties. Okay. Now, it turns out that, again, if we look at the entanglement entropy of the ground state of the system, in this case, remember, we are in two dimensions. So in this case, we would expect that the entanglement entropy would scale as being proportional to the size, the linear size of the block, so the boundary of the block. It turns out that there is some correction to that. Okay? So here there is some constant, and this constant is non-universal. Oh-ho, my time is up or something. No, 5 minutes. All right. So this one is universal. And so this is, again, big. It turns out that this gamma is nothing but, what is it? It's the logarithm of the total quantum dimension. Okay. So what does this mean? Again, so you have this very complicated system. You don't know what the quasi-particles are. You don't even know how to compute most of this. But if you just look at the entanglement entropy as a function of L, so say this is L1, L2, L3, L4, and you get some points here, okay? But at some point, this become regular for large L. And then you extrapolate back, okay? You'll get here some number, which is gamma, okay? So it's this distance. Gamma is this distance. And just by doing this experiment here, numerical experiment, where you compute how entanglement scales, you go back and you learn the total quantum dimension. Okay? So you go back to your table and you say, OK, I don't know. So first, this actually is the first time that we have a way of showing that we have topological order in a positive way. So usually topological order was characterized by we don't have other things happening, right? But so you had to look at all other parameters, see that they vanish. So that it was a mess because you never knew if you forgot to look at some other parameter that you didn't know of. Okay, so but here, if you find that your topological entanglement entropy is positive, automatically you know that you have an anion model with a total quantum dimension that is non-zero. Okay, so this is a way of diagnosing whether your system is topologically ordered. And the other thing is that actually there is a final the structure of possible anion models is such that you have a discrete that if you give me the quantum dimension, maybe there are 3 or 4 theories with the same quantum dimension, but I've learned already a lot. Okay? So I quickly determine, okay, it must be one of these 3 theories. Good. So maybe one thing that you should all be asking is, okay, so in the first lecture, we talked about entanglement. We talked about bipartite entanglement. We had part A and part B. And we saw all this spectrum, all this Schmidt decomposition, right? The Schmidt decomposition was telling us, and I told you that all the coefficients in the Schmidt decomposition were relevant as far as entanglement is concerned. But then we went to study many-body problems, many-body systems, and we forgot about that. We're just looking at the entanglement entropy, okay? And it turns out that it's very useful. For instance, I argued just just before that by looking at the entanglement entropy, how it scales, we already learned a lot about the universality class, both for critical systems in 1 plus 1 and for topologically ordered systems in 2 plus 1. Okay? So we've learned a lot. This is very useful. But can we go back and look at what we're missing? Can we go back to the Schmidt decomposition? And it turns out that the answer is yes. And I don't have a lot of time to explain this, or I have no time at all to explain this. But it turns out that if you look, so far we were looking at the density matrix, right, for region A. And all we care about, so from here we could extract all the Schmidt coefficients. But now so far we've been looking only at the entropy. Okay, so we had all these Schmidt coefficients. Maybe the Schmidt coefficients were the square root of that. And now we've been investigating all we can learn just by looking at the entropy. Okay, and for a while this has dominated this research area. So just looking at the entanglement entropy. And this now is something that it's done also in string theory. They are obsessed with, or in the ADS-CFT correspondence, they look at holographic ways of computing this quantity. So it's a whole business now. But since recently, we've started to look back into the Hall spectrum. Okay, and now what we have is this notion of entanglement spectrum. Entanglement spectrum. That's the name that it's being used. And it's nothing but defining some entanglement energy. It's called entanglement energy, which is nothing but taking the logarithm of the Schmidt coefficient. Okay. And if you do that, then you just look at the entanglement spectrum, and you can learn much more. Not, for instance, in the CFT. In the CFT, you can learn not just the central charge, but you can learn about the scaling dimensions. You can learn much more data. And for instance, for the CFT, this is important. If C is equal to 1, this there are many. So I told you that for C smaller than 1, we only had a discrete set. Okay, but for C equal to 1, if the central charge is equal to 1, you look at the entanglement scaling, you learn, okay, C equal to 1. Now what? Okay, it turns out that there are infinitely many CFTs. So CFTs with C equal to 1, there are infinitely many. And for instance, a family is called free bosons with compactification. Ratio or radius, a compactification radius R. Okay, so R is a continuous parameter. Each value of R gives you a different CFT. Now, if you look at if you just look at the scaling of entropy, you can only learn that this is C equal to 1. But it turns out that if you look now at the whole spectrum, you can learn about what CFT you have. You can learn about the radius, the compactification radius. And this one really gives you, it's again a complete characterization. Okay, so looking at the entanglement spectrum gives you much more information, also about universal properties of the system. And the same story goes, but time is up, for systems with topological order. So if we just look at the entropy, again, in this case, we'll learn about the total quantum dimension, maybe it's equal to 2 for the Ising model, for the toric code. But if we go back to the Schmidt coefficient, we can learn much, much more. Okay? In particular, in systems with topological order, include fractional quantum Hall states. And in that case, you have, and this I'm just telling you in case that rings a bell. So you have, at the boundary of your system, you have conformal field theory, a chiral CFT. And it turns out that if you look at the entanglement spectrum, in that case, you learn about this CFT. And that, again, completely characterizes the topological order that you have. Okay? So we've focused this week on entanglement entropy, but there is much more to it. Okay? There is the whole entanglement spectrum. And from there, you can even learn much more. And I think that's it. So, right, so I wanted to show you some examples of papers that came out last month, for instance, explaining how you can find the compactification radius just by looking at the time spectrum, but we don't have time for that. But the main idea is that this is a very, very active line of research at the moment, and it really involves not just, I mean, it started in quantum information, studying entanglement. You know, we were bored, let's study something. But now it turns out that this is very useful when you apply it to many body systems. And as I said before, this is being investigated in the context of ADS-CFT. For instance, in the house, we have Rob Myers computing entanglement entropy for in systems, in the context of the holographic principle. But you have people like Xiaogang Wen studying this in the context of topological order, quantum criticality, and so on. Okay? All right. Any more questions?
So can we experiment or measure?
I'm sorry?
Experimental.
So there have been steps in that direction. You can actually compute. Remember, we had this Reni entropies? So not just the entanglement entropy, but the Reni entropy with alpha. For alpha equal to 2, I think Dima Abening, who is also in the house, was involved in a proposal how to measure entanglement entropy. Yes? There have been experimental proposals. I mean, theoretical proposals for experiments. It's not the same, right? I don't know. Yeah, but if you want to learn more about this, so Dima Abanin, is he teaching this year, or did he teach?
He will be teaching next year.
Next year, okay. But well, one of the junior professors in condensed matter here.
He Dima. Review.
Okay. So he would be the right person to ask. So the answer is yes, you can do something. They have proposed a way.
The proposal was that they coupled the two state systems with a cold atom system, which is actually fairly realizable, or fairly feasible.
You are also in theory, no? You also do theory. Yeah. I mean, okay, we'll see when this is done in practice, but yeah, there are ideas how to do it. All right.
Are you claiming Hiroshima coefficient that you can determine physical theory?
So it turns out that if you look at the Schmidt coefficients, they are organized. They tell you about, there is this notion of boundary CFT. And so what's happening is that every time you have, say in one dimension, every time you consider a block of size L, what the entanglement spectrum behaves as if you had, or tell you about the physics as if you had really a boundary. So this is happening also in two dimensions. In two dimensions, you have a region of size a, region A. And if you look at the entanglement between the inside and the outside, this entanglement, if you look at the entanglement spectrum, you will learn about the physics of this system if you actually didn't have more than just the block. So this boundary that you have for the block, if you look at the entanglement spectrum, you'll learn about the physics of the same system if A was the whole system. Okay? So you can learn about boundary CFT in 1 plus 1, or you can learn about the chiral theory, the H theory, in 2 plus 1. So it's really, well, it's quite a spectacular how much you can learn. The eigenvalue of the density matrix?
Yeah.
So this is the density matrix. You look at its spectrum. And the entanglement spectrum actually is the logarithm of these eigenvalues. It's just nice to write it this way. Okay?